Leo, thank you very much for joining us on Reasonable Doubts.
You're welcome.
So you have a very fascinating story and are doing a lot of good work. But let's get a little bit of background first. You were raised in Nigeria.
Yes.
And at a young age, you were enrolled as a seminary student?
Yes, yes. I was born in the southern part of Nigeria, which I call the Bible Belt.
The Bible Belt of Nigeria?
Yeah, it's the Bible Belt of Nigeria. Yeah, because if you really want access in terms of politics or social programs, you just need to hold a Bible. That's all you need. That's the key to, you know, the society in terms of programs and power. Yeah. So, and being a Bible Belt, I attended Catholic primary schools, and then I went to seminary because mission schools are the same, maybe about the best we could get in my own part of the country. Yeah. So, but in the course of my seminary formation, I studied philosophy, and I was doing my theology program maybe. I did my theology program for a few months, let's say 3 months, then I couldn't take it any longer. So, I couldn't take it any longer.
Philosophy tends to do that. It tends to erode faith.
Yes. And that was really I was very fortunate because I studied, you know, philosophy before I started theology. So it wasn't the other way around, you know. So it was like, I mean, if I had done it the other way around, maybe I would have been in the seminary because, you know, philosophy will be enlightening and you will feel like staying, you know. But after philosophy, they tried to teach me theology. It was too nonsensical for me, so I couldn't take it, yeah.
And how did your family and community react to your growing doubts?
Well, they were suspicious because if you doubt anything that has to do with religion and God, you know, it's like you are the devil, you know, you are a monster, you know, you are evil. Yes. So because everything belief is identified with a virtuous life. So religious belief is identified with a virtuous life. So if you doubt religious belief, it means that you are evil. So what I did was that I moved away from my own village and from my community. You know, I now moved. I was born in southeast, the southeastern part of Nigeria. So I moved to the southwest of Nigeria. So we are, you know, my family members were not there as such, and there wasn't that pressure for me either to remain religious or to be religious. So I moved away to the southwest. That's where I'm currently living now, you know, where my family is now. Then that was where, you know, I started rediscovering myself. Because when I left the seminary as well, it was like I wanted to live on my own terms. I don't want to live as a result of somebody else's terms. What somebody wants me to be, I wanted to be what I wanted to be, you know, and I wanted to live on my own terms. And that gave me that space to discover myself, not just as a humanist. And that gave me also that courage, you know, to establish the humanist movement, which for me was a kind of a platform for social engagement. Mm-hmm. Because I know that there are a lot of problems my society has been facing. My society is still facing as I'm talking to you here now, you know, as a result of superstition, as a result of religious fanaticism and extremism. And I found the humanist outlook resourceful. You know, I found it useful, you know, in terms of contributing for social change, in terms of fighting, you know, for social transformation.
So these were not just abstract philosophical principles. You could see this making a difference in everyday life.
No. You know, my philosophical training, you know, of course, exposed me to a lot of all those abstract things. Being qua being, can't we talk about the noumenon and the phenomenon and all that. So when you are reading it, you just ask yourself, I mean, what's this all about? And sometimes if you read metaphysics and religion, you could see some similarities. So I was exposed to those philosophical thoughts and thinking. But, you know, one thing we don't know is that they have a way of also sharpening our cognitive skills. Mm-hmm. They have a way of making you not easily gullible, not gullible, in other words, you cannot easily accept something. When somebody, you know, says something, you have to ask questions. That is it. The philosophical training cultivated the habit of asking questions. It sharpened my critical thinking skills. And I found out that many people are suffering, many people are dying because of gullibility. You know, because they live in a situation where they think that is virtuous, to be gullible. You know, when you are gullible, in other words, when you can easily accept what a pope says, what the bishop says, what the traditional ruler says, sometimes even what politician says, you know, that makes you maybe a good citizen and a good person. But no, I discovered the virtue in skepticism. I discovered the virtue in critical thinking. And that was why I said it was not just a virtue for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it should be something I should put at the disposal of the society. That's it. That's how I drew the connection. And today, when I look back to that decision, I think that, you know, it remains one of the best decisions I've made in my life.
The virtue of critical thinking and trying to spread that around and hopefully see it make a real change in others' lives the way it did yours. What specifically were some of the social ills you saw around you that you felt resulted from this gullibility or this lack of skepticism and critical thinking?
In fact, they're numerous. There's so many. Okay? So first of all, I grew up in a community where people believe that they can make money using human body parts. In other words, you can go to a witch doctor and a witch doctor could tell you, okay, get the head of somebody in your family. Get the intestine, get the eyes for some kind of ritual sacrifice. Yes. I'm not saying this maybe because I want to paint Africans, you know, barbaric people. This is what is going on.
Yeah.
It's what is going on in my society, and it's a fact. Because it's a social fact, the impression you make out of it, that is your business. Mm-hmm. But it is such a horrendous, such a horrifying, such a traumatic experience that I found out that now, as I was growing up, I had to ask questions. Mm-hmm. Can you really make money in any form using human heads and as a form of ritual sacrifice? The answer is no. But to my people, yes. They can do it. And because of that, and you know why he's thriving, this narrative, this superstitious narrative, has not been challenged. Mm-hmm. And even if you have some doubts, you don't express that openly. So that if you try to question things like that, people will think that, oh, you are being a bit foolhardy. In other words, you are being stupid or you are taking unnecessary risk. Mm-hmm. So, like now, on several occasions, you will read in the newspapers that, oh, you saw some torso or, you know, a kind of body without a head or legs or something chopped off. Or you will see somebody with the intestines removed and you ask yourself, they said, it's for rituals. Now, ritual, you must have had maybe the case of the albinos in Tanzania and East Africa, or maybe if you've not heard about that, they have the problem, you know, in the East Africa whereby people with albinism, you know, they believe that their skin has some magical powers, you know, and that when they kill them, they try to use the skin of the albinos, you know, for rituals, which they think that can make people lucky, make people fortunate, or enhance their fortune or success. Yeah. So
it's not always just random. This becomes a way to target particular individuals in the community.
Yes. Yes. The target are people with albinism.
Yeah.
Again, they target people with a hunchback. I don't know whether you have things like that here. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, because they have the belief that a hump has something in it which they can use for ritual purposes. Huh. So what they do is that they get these people and really butcher them like animals and take the hump away. So, you know, I was growing up with this. And, you know, as a child, when you ask questions, they say, shut up. Mm-hmm. When you grow up, you get to know this. You know, just stay away from things like this. And, you know, as I was growing up, I keep asking, but how? Where? Why? Mm-hmm. Nobody was ready to give me answers. Even up till now, there are still people that feel that, yes, I have not grown up enough to understand the mystery and the mysticism and the magical power behind it. And I said, enough is enough. Yeah. Because skepticism has a way of equipping you, emboldening you to ask those questions.
Yeah.
And when you can't get the evidence, when you can't get evidence-based answers, you keep asking, and then you can transform a questioning process into a campaign for, you know, social improvement, for social change, and for positive change.
Do you think there's a lot of other people who maybe have strong doubts, but they just haven't been equipped with the right tools to question in that way, or haven't been emboldened to question? I imagine there are people out there hearing your message and saying, I've been thinking this my whole life.
Yes.
I've just never had the courage to say it.
Yes, there are. And that is why sometimes when you paint Africans with the same brush, Africans are deeply religious, Africans are, what do you call it, dogmatic, those things are not representative. That they misrepresent the situations. There are people that are religious, yes. There are fanatics, yes. There are superstitious people, yes. There are also skeptics. There are critical thinkers. But there are also critical thinkers in the open or who have gone public. There are people who are covert skeptics or skeptics in the closet, you see. So, but look at the challenge. Those who are in the closet, the covert skeptics, sometimes they don't want to do anything for them to be publicly and visibly identified with overt skepticism. So, and that is why you see these problems going on. And again, that is why you don't see it happening, let's say, in every family, every time and every day.
Yeah.
So in other words, there are people who don't do it because they don't believe in it. But they don't take action openly against those who are doing it. Mm-hmm. And that is why you see some of these atrocities being committed in the open. Like when we talk about witchcraft accusation, there are many Africans that don't believe in witchcraft, that they think that people are superstitious. But they don't want to get entangled in the campaign against it. So they do nothing. Because of that, the practice continues. So that is that's a challenge. And that is why I think what Africa needs now is proactive skepticism. So it's not enough to tell me, I don't believe in this. What are you doing to address it when people commit atrocities in the name? And if you do nothing, if you shrink from taking action, you are tacitly also endorsing what those people are doing. And that's why the fanatics, the extremists, be them religious and superstitious, are acting with this kind of impunity. Hmm.
Well, I mean, you are a good example yourself as someone who has faced real life suffering for standing out for critical thinking and skepticism.
Yeah.
I read that you personally have been jailed several times.
Yeah.
Your family members have been attacked due to this. So
it's a
real risk. But
clearly
you feel it's worth it.
Yeah, it is a real risk. But now, in 2008, a high school boy beheaded the uncle for rituals. Okay? In other words, he went to a witch doctor. They said, okay, you need the head of somebody in your family. And he went and beheaded the uncle. This one happened in my village. I didn't read it in newspapers. Now, what happened to that man? He's dead. So the risk I face, for me, is a reflection of the risk everybody faces in that society. Anybody who lives in a society where people believe that they can behead you, take off your head or take your eyes or intestine to go and make rituals is at risk.
Yeah.
So all of us are at risk.
That's an excellent point.
Yes. So why can't one person take a risk in order to bring an end or to reduce the risk other people face? So I can also sacrifice, you know, say a kind of my own life or put my own life more at risk in order to reduce the risk other people face. I think that this is a better path to follow. You know, instead of just, you know, being there, keeping quiet and being at risk at the same time. Yes.
Right.
And again, yes, now I have taken those steps. I think that less number of people are at risk today because of what I'm doing. So that even if I face the risk, but because other people are less at risk today, I feel happier with it, even with the risk I face.
And you and others like you provide an example to everyone else who's slightly more, you know, who may be thinking the same thing but more afraid to speak up.
Yeah.
They get to look at your example.
Yes. Like now, there are more people who are getting involved now because it was like, Lou, I can't do this thing you're doing. You know, I agree with what you're doing, but I don't have the courage to do it. These are what some of my friends told me. You know, but, you know, right now, people are finding out that, it is, in quote, not really as dangerous. It's dangerous, like I must say. But, you know, some people, like my family members, many of them thought I would have been killed by now. Okay? And even when I faced all the troubles, they would say, okay, look, we told you. But like I said, I'm not even driven so much by the risk I face, but by the risk the whole society faces. Look at the number of children that are abandoned in the name of witchcraft. Look at the number of women that are driven out, beaten up. Look at the number of them that are killed. You know, some of them are killed and nobody has a trace as to how they were killed and where they were killed. They are silently killed because of the charged nature of the belief. So if we live in such a situation, it is okay for me to risk my life in the quest of trying to secure the situation, particularly for vulnerable people who don't have a voice. You get it? Today I can say I have some voice. You get it? But let me use my voice to speak on their behalf.
Yeah. It sounds like, I mean, I before reading about you and your work, I wasn't all that familiar that there even was a problem with human sacrifice. I wasn't aware that that was a practice. And I imagine some of these issues are really hard to quantify because so much of it goes you know, below the
radar. Yes, underground. Yes. Yeah. That is a problem. And that is why sometimes people will ask you, how many? You know, here, particularly in our own part of the world, I'm talking over here in the US and Europe, people are, you know, want to have statistics, okay? Mm-hmm. And that is where we have failed. In spiritual matters, religiously, when it comes to religious issues, sometimes it's difficult to quantify what people do or refuse to do. It's difficult to quantify the victims because the people, it's often the people who are victimized. You know, nothing is said. They can't come out and say, yes, I'm victimized. So sometimes it's a silent war going on. That's what I've said. There's a silent war going on. They are not using bombs. They're not using Kalashnikovs. They're not using drones. They are using superstition. Yes, and it's killing people silently. It's eliminating people silently. So what we just do is that when we have one graphic case, we try to promote it so much, you know, so that we can use it to drive home the message. We can use it to pass across the message and get people to understand that, yes, it may be one or two happening this year. We know. But there may be 10 or 20. We don't know. So, but since we have known one or two, please let us put all our energy and make sure that even this one does not happen again.
Yes. One of those particular things that you have had a good hand in popularizing and bringing awareness to the problem, making it less of a silent problem, is, again, the witchcraft accusations in Africa.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about the background of this.
There are so many dimensions to it, okay? Now, of course, there's always this notion sometimes European and African scholars, they try to tell you maybe in Africa they have no religion, they have no culture, they have no civilization, maybe until maybe the Europeans came and said, oh, yeah, this is culture, this is religion. I think it's such a very, you know, a case of misrepresentation. Mm-hmm. People had made sense of their own life in their own way. You know, and of course, there were contacts, there were influences from other cultures, you know, just like also there was influences on other cultures here. So witchcraft, magical thinking, mystical thinking was what was dominant. Many people didn't have access to what we call the canons of modern science, you know, and many people just based their own explanation of events by through mystical thinking or using magic. So it is within this kind of terrain, it is within this kind of framework that you see they believe in witchcraft thrives. But it is not every case that people associate with witchcraft. Mm-hmm. In other words, it is not everything people are doing. It is not every case of misfortune that people associate with witchcraft. So witchcraft is a label which is applied. Mm-hmm. It's a label generated by people and applied on others.
And who are the others that usually get this applied? I mean, what would gain you getting accused of being a witch?
Now, you risk being accused if you are getting old, aging, elderly people. These are people at risk.
Yeah.
Yes. You risk being accused if you're a woman. You risk being accused if you are if you don't have children, because children are kind of they provide some kind of social support. Right. So a woman in a family is stronger if the woman has children. But you may have children, but they are not educated. They are children that can't withstand any kind of a kind of oppression, as the case may be. You also risk being accused if you're a widow, if your husband is dead. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it seems to be the most vulnerable socially.
These are the vulnerable. And that's why there's a power factor, you know, when it comes to witchcraft. And that is why You. Many people believe that there are some spiritual forces and that these spiritual forces can be used or manipulated for good or for ill. But as to who is that person being used by the spiritual forces to cause my misfortune becomes brings another dimension to it. And so the vulnerable people are the people that can easily have these labels applied on them without resistance. Mm-hmm. And that is why when you look at the whole scenario, if you go to the Democratic Republic of Congo, the street children that are accused are children, orphans, children whose maybe parents are dead or separated, or children born to a woman who is married off to another man or something like that. Or you go to...
I've heard deformities are very common, like that will...
Yes. Yeah. Or children in Ghana, children who are deformed, which is children who are disabled, you know, who are born disabled, you know, who are a kind of a burden to the parents in terms of management, because many people give birth to children with little or no resource. They don't have the means to take care of children. So So when the child comes now with a kind of deformity, which they cannot imagine, they think, yeah, I'm cursed. Why is it that this person's child was born abled? No, nothing wrong with him or her. And mine is born maybe without a hand or born without, you know, this or that, or born with, you know, a very big skull and all that. So many of them start questioning, and that is when they start evoking the magical, mystical, witchcraft narratives. This is what they use to make sense of that. And before you know, they want to get rid of that child, you know, because the presence of that child is the presence of evil. The presence of that child haunts them. The presence of that child, you know, makes them look at themselves as people who have been cursed or who are kind of under the radar of the devil, you know, and therefore, you know, for oppression and maltreatment.
So it seems that the superstitious elements play very well into the hand of real human needs and tragedies. I mean, there's a burden placed on the community. It's just instead of coming together and taking care of it in some sort of way, these are cast aside.
Yes. You see now,
but not everywhere. You've worked in these refuges before for these children. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about that? The particular communities or sanctuaries where people can who are accused of witchcraft go to live?
Yes. In Nigeria, there was, you know, there's still a place where these children are taken to, you know. What happens there, of course, when people experience any form of misfortune, divorce, marital issues, infertility, business failure, that starts from their jobs, accidents, they try to look for an explanation. Mm-hmm. And many times, again, there are what I call the occult entrepreneurs. They are the occult producers and managers. You go to them with your problem, and they give it an occultic wrapping. They package it. In other words, they make you to understand, look, there is somebody in the family who is responsible. And you say, And through the interview, the person can maybe give you a clue or through code reading, get you to say, oh, is this child or is this person? And immediately is identified, the question is elimination. Because when you eliminate the person, that is the only way to restore the moral integrity of your family. So you now go, and immediately such a person is identified, people treat the person in a very wicked way. You know, they treat the person in a cruel way. So these children, they're beaten, they're burnt with acid, they have fuel poured on them. They just try to eliminate them. Just like when there is something evil, like maybe there's a poisonous snake that gets into your room and you have a stick on your hand, the next thing you have to hit it on the head and make sure it dies right away. That is the way they look at these things. So that is why it is dangerous. Believing witchcraft is a kind of a virus. It's poisonous to the communities. So these children are the ones who suffer that. So what they do is that they drive them out. So these shelters were established. And I was involved in rescuing some of these children from these communities and taking them to these shelters, you know. But of course, there were challenges. There were challenges because, first of all, the government felt that we were giving the government a bad image because we were bringing all these stories and bringing all the photos and they, you know, try to highlight the problem. Like I said, it is important we get people to understand the scale of the problem we're having.
Yeah.
Because when people understand the scale of the problem, then they know the kind of resource, the kind of attention to give to it. But if they don't have the scale of the problem, they can't do anything. Yes. Yeah. So that was what we were doing, you know, try to get people to understand the scale of the problem we are having. But of course, the government, the local government, local authorities were not very happy with it.
It's easier to just bury the problem.
Good. Yes.
Yeah.
Allow it go underground. Okay. So that was what they wanted, you know. And that is not, I thought and I still think, is important to get the world to understand the complexity of the problem, the complicated nature of the problem, the graphic nature of the abuses going on. And I know that when you do it that way, groups might get involved in some form or another because we need a kind of, approach from different ends, you know, to get this problem, you know, resolved.
That's what I've seen people talking about this issue, even responding to some of your articles, saying that, well, we need to address the economic aspects of this and, you know, and the problems of resource scarcity and everything else before this is truly going to be taken care of, which you acknowledge. You just add, we also need to address the beliefs behind it.
Sure. Do you know what? Let me tell you why it is important. Beliefs, people's beliefs, they shape their action. They determine their action. Beliefs are like frames. Okay? Actions are like the content. Beliefs, they frame the content. Like now, I think it was Kant that said, you know, forms without content is empty. Mm-hmm. And content without forms, you know, they're blind. You know, so the beliefs are like the framing that actions are the content. So it is the belief that shape people's action.
Yeah.
So I'm so interested in the belief. I'm interested in it because a lot of people who said, oh, you can still believe in witchcraft but don't abuse children. I said, false. Germans will say, false. Germans, that's what the Germans will say. No, not at all, please. Don't tell me that. Am I going there to tell people what to believe? Not really, okay? There's freedom of belief, but there is also freedom to criticize beliefs. There is freedom to hold contrary beliefs. There are freedom to question beliefs. So I want a free inquiry atmosphere. Yes. That's what I need.
At the very least, allow people to actually discuss this in their communities without fear of reprisals.
Yes.
I found this was interesting. You know, of course, you mentioned we started the interview. You mentioned the kind of the privilege of some is attached to these beliefs.
Yeah.
Especially the – what did you call them? The occult specialists?
Yeah, the occult entrepreneurs.
Entrepreneurs.
Yes.
One of them in particular, Helen
– Okpabio.
Yeah, Okpabio.
Yeah. Yes.
She was became infamous in the UK and over here in the United States after all these documentaries featured how she was she was promoting this idea that many of these children are witches.
Yes.
And even had graphic videos with depicting children, witch children.
Yes, children flying out at night and going to attack other people.
Eating dead bodies and things like that.
Yes. You see, that is the problem. You know, we also have issues on, of course, the film industry as an artwork and things like that. Mm-hmm. And where lies the limit and all that? You know, I am happy that at the end of this world, many people around the world are beginning to understand the kind of poison Helen Okpabio has been spreading.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get it? So now, he's not spreading this poison in a culture or among the people that have a lot of skeptical, I don't know how to call it, is it skeptical genes or something like that? Or I'm talking about immunity against the poison.
Yes.
Do you get it? People with a lot of antidote, you know, in their system. He's spreading it amongst people whose system cannot resist these things. That is the danger. And that is why Helen Okpabio and her ministry, they are dangerous, you know, to cultural reformation, cultural renaissance, that are dangerous in terms of the rights of people, you know, the rights of children. What she's doing put many children at risk, endanger the life of not only children but also elderly people because her activities are recharging the witchcraft narratives and even, you know, bringing so many dimensions to it. So that was a problem. And I am happy that she eventually lost out because initially she brought a lot of court cases. She clamped down on her program. She sent her church members to disrupt a seminar we held, just a seminar to discuss. Like you said, we need a kind of an uninhibited and unhindered atmosphere where we can look at all these beliefs and claims. Yeah. Okay. So, but we took this seminar to the headquarters of our church. She mobilized more people than those who attended our seminars to overtake the place and all that. So, because she doesn't want that kind of free expression, free examination, free discussion of witchcraft narratatives, which is what we need, you know, to enlighten people. So, but I'm happy that the board, many people around the world are beginning to understand that she wanted to come here. You know, that was in 2012.
Yeah.
You know,
backers here in the United States.
Yeah, she has supporters here.
Surprising.
Yes. Yeah. And she has backers even in the UK and I guess in many other parts of the world. Do you get it? But I'm happy that, you know, the message has been sent, even though I don't think that she has had that message very well.
Yeah.
But the message has been sent there that, look, you know, what we are doing, people are watching, people are not happy with it, and we are going to stop her, or we're going to stop her anytime we get a wink of what she's doing, you know, and to make sure that she stops spreading this poison.
It does lead me to a further question, though, is this is done under the guise of Christianity, in particular a kind of Pentecostal version of Christianity, which I hear is on the rise throughout Africa.
Yeah.
How do you view the role of Christianity and Islam, two of the major religious influences, as playing into all of this? Is it a help? Does it help at all in countering some of the more superstitious narratives, or is it a hindrance, do you think?
If I'm to say it, you know, there isn't anything that is human. You might not get something positive about it.
Right, right.
Okay? Yes, because religion is not divine. Religion is human. Mm-hmm. Even the idea of divine is human. You know, we created those constructs on divinity. So, of course, people have always asked me this question. They try to put me in a situation whereby, is it a force of evil or a force of good? Okay? Now, I want to say it because Islam, religion, superstition, witchcraft, they're all irrational notions. They are all superstitious notions. And at the root of this problem is irrationalism, is superstition. Is supernaturalism. Based on that, Islam and Christianity are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. But I know that there are Christians, individual Christians, who will tell you, yes, my Christianity doesn't accommodate this. Mm-hmm. If there is something I find that is evil in my religion, I pray for it and God will answer my prayer or whatever. I pray against it, okay? Mm-hmm. In other words, they don't just get out to burn children, attack children, persecute them. I cannot put them on the same box with people who also get children locked up,
right?
Beat them, starve them to death or something, all in the name of exercising them. I can't put them on that same box. You get it? But I will tell you that Islam and Christianity are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Now, let me explain again why I think it's part of the problem. Recently, you may have heard that Pope Francis, you know, recognized what is called the International Association of Exorcists.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you get it? Now, for me, I don't know. I was so sad the day I had that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I'm still very sad. And I still don't have...
Everything has been indicating that he's a more enlightened pope.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, I don't believe it.
Okay,
I don't believe it.
Yeah.
I think Pope Francis is acting out of pressure. Mm-hmm. He became a pope at a time the Catholic Church, the profile of the Catholic Church.
Yeah,
or something.
Very bad PR, we might say, here in America. Public relations disaster.
Relation. Yes. The of course, the pedophile cases, Vatican Bank, corruption there, here and there. So many other problems. So he's trying to launder the image. He's trying to, improve on the image of the Catholic Church. He's acting out of pressure. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's why he's doing those things. And when he recognized the International Association or whatever exorcist, I was saying, come on, this is a medieval pope.
Yeah.
Okay, look at it. Because exorcism, witch hunting, is a form of exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that whether witch hunters, whether they are priests or what they call the witch doctors or traditional, what they do is that they try to do some incantation to remove the witchcraft powers from the person who is accused. So recognizing that is recognizing witch hunting. Sanctifying exorcism is sanctifying witch hunting. And like I told you, the impact is going to have a lot of impact, not even in Rome, which I know that many people don't care about what the Pope says, or even in many parts of the United States. I know that many people here, particularly the white Catholic followers, they don't care they don't care so much about what the Pope says. But it's going to have a lot of impact.
Yeah.
In places like Africa, where they have the immunity is still very low, like I told you, because they don't have the antidote to contain and counteract, the poisonous messages, that coming out as a result of that. So that is why I'm trying to say that the Catholic Church or the Christian religion is also part of the problem.
Yeah, I think we have, like, over here we have the attitude where, like, okay, so he endorsed a group of exorcists.
Yeah.
Well, that's a curiosity. It gets buried on the back page of the newspaper as one of those stranger-than-fiction stories.
Good.
We rarely encounter this happening in our communities that we're aware of. It does happen, actually.
Yeah.
But we rarely see it.
Yeah.
And we don't think of how this is going to impact people throughout the world.
Yeah.
And we need to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. And that is a problem. That is one thing I said. You know, we should start taking a global approach to some of these issues. Because sometimes people have this feeling that, oh, yeah. You know, like now when something like that is said, because of the way people, live in their own society, they think it's not an issue. It's a lot of issue. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, Pope Francis, by virtue of that, by that same pronouncement, for me is a disaster. Is a disaster, particularly when it comes to our efforts to stop witch hunting. Because many many Catholic priests now are going to come up formally and informally as exorcists. And whatever they do is that any little problem you have, they say, oh, it's a witchcraft, oh, it's evil spirit, they're going to remove it from you, or they're going to expel it from you. I mean, Pope was talking about, is it seeing the devil or something? You know, he was in the report, he was talking about the fact that, you know, he could identify the devil in somebody. The devil in somebody?
Well, so if the Pope can do that.
Do you get it? What do you expect?
Yeah, right.
What do you expect in the communities? Now, this might be on a very, in a different note. There was something that is happening in my community now. I was told that a Catholic priest came and performed exorcism in my own community. Yes, in southeastern Nigeria, they just told me. And in the course of that, he identified the trees where he says evil spirits were living, I don't know how to really describe it, because, when you talk about living, you talk about a house, but, maybe you can help me.
Maybe indwell the trees or something like that. I don't know.
I don't know. But that is the notion. The notion is that the evil spirits were using the trees as operational basis.
Okay.
So, and you know what happens when he points at a tree and said, the evil spirits are operating from here? What they do? They cut it down. So they ended up cutting down a tree that belongs to a powerful person. Take note. Mm-hmm. And the guy wasn't in the community when that happened. So when he came back, he was very upset.
Yeah. Understandably. Why are you taking down my tree?
Yeah. They get it. So he had to go to the police. Yeah. So the thing has been causing a lot of problem in the communities.
Okay.
So now, like I said, he's now empowering these people.
Yeah.
He's now telling them, please go ahead. He's now making people now, they start seeing devils everywhere as a result of their problems. That is the damage the Pope is doing to us. And the last Pope, or the one before the last, apologized, sometime at the 2000. John Paul apologized for the atrocities. This one has started the same atrocity again. Look at this. Yes.
Yeah.
And we need to tell him, we need to call him to order.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you for sharing your story and for all the work you do to actually make a difference in these areas. Again, sometimes at great personal risk to yourself and to your family. What I'm wondering is, for listeners of this show, and we do have a global audience.
Yeah.
How can we be a part of this global solution and help you? Are there organizations we can donate to, or ways we can spread the word?
Yeah, there are organizations you can donate to, and I know that there are many organizations that are doing work in this area. They're increasing in their number. And
do you have any that you would like to?
I think Foundation Beyond Belief, they're doing some work. They have this, what they call the Pathfinder Project, and which is slowly metamorphosing or changing to they have to. Is going to tend to what they call the Humanist Service Corps project.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're going to do some work in Ghana, in the witch camps and all that, so people can support them.
Cool.
Yeah. And of course, I know that the Center for Inquiry is doing some work in Kenya, and maybe in some other places. People can also support them. International Humanist and Ethical Union, they're also doing some great work, supporting some groups. And all that. So the happy thing, or the what I'm happy with now, is that there are many organizations that are coming out, that are trying to do something to help us. But more importantly, I always tell people, don't be restricted in terms of your support by what I say or what I recommend. Do what you think you can do.
Yeah.
Like now, giving me a space to share this, my story with you, is a form of support. Yes, it is a form of support. Helping put the news out there is a form of, like I told you from the beginning, let us get people on to understand the scale of this problem. Everybody knows how he or she could support. Many times when we issued press releases, all of a sudden you see people putting it in their blog and all that. It's because they have gotten to know the urgency of the matter. Mm-hmm. That's how they give us support. And that's how we have succeeded so far, either in stopping Helen from coming here or in publicizing what she wanted to do in the UK or publicizing the visit of a homophobic pastor, you know, to Australia and all that. It is because we have people out there who now understand it. Mm-hmm. So those who are helping us publicize this, that are giving us, for me, you know, support, I value even much more than money. So if there is any little thing you can do, put it on the blog, organize a small meeting, or maybe if somebody is coming around, let a person come and inform you about what is going on. I think it can also help us so that bit by bit by bit, I think that we can slowly, you know, collapse this structure of witch hunting, this structure of witchcraft accusation and abuses in the name of superstition or magical thinking.
And such a good goal to put our efforts behind. So you heard that, listeners. Do what you can to share these stories to promote critical thinking in your communities and around the world. And a great way you can start by doing that is to check out Leo Igwe's writings. We're going to have a link to several of his articles on our blog and some of the organizations he just mentioned. Check that out at www.doubtcast.org. And Leo Igwe, thank you so much for what you do around the world to promote better lives through critical thinking. And thank you for joining us on Reasonable Doubts.
Yeah. Thank you so much also for all that you do to get some reasonable doubt out there.